Blog Talk Radio.
Start your video again.
It's preparing now. And good afternoon. Hi, my name is Ann McMillan. I am the master wealth builder, helping you to build a stronger and better life and business. And we want to welcome you to another episode of hashtag My Investing Story. Ione McMillan and I are volunteers with Better Investing, and we're very excited every single every week on Wednesday to bring to you another episode of My Investing Story. And we want to remind you that this phenomenal organization, Better Investing, is a nonprofit organization, and our mission is to educate individual investors and investment clubs to become successful lifelong investors. This organization was founded in 1951 as the National Association of Investment Clubs, better known now as Better Investing. And Better Investing has helped over 5 million people from all walks of life learn how to improve our financial future. And so tonight we want to add that value to you and want to remind you, please consider to comment, like, and share this show. The organization was born out of the conviction that anyone can become a successful lifelong stock investor by following sound, practical investing principles. And so as volunteers, we want to make sure you know we're not selling any products, not selling any services. We're not making any stock recommendations, no hot tips or anything like that. Our desire is to bring to you individuals who are willing to share their investing stories. And so tonight we have another phenomenal guest here to share his story. And he is none other than Julius Mansa. And Julius, we had an opportunity to talk, and he's a very interesting person, which you're going to find as the show starts. But he has been an operation finance and accounting professional for over 15 years. And Julius, I have to say, you don't look old, but you know, it's experience is everything. But he has he's done extremely well in the financial services industry, which includes real estate, logistics, and nonprofit sector. His career includes various corporate finance roles, ranging from senior financial analyst to financial controller in the logistics and real estate development sectors. So we're going to have Julius tell you a little bit more about his story, and Ione will delve into that. So I'm not going to read all of your bio, Julius, because I think your story is going to reveal the fact that as a CFO for an Indianapolis-based real estate development firm, and CFO doing consulting, that as you open MaxPoint Advisors and all of the work that you're doing and all of this experience is going to come through as a part of your story. So let's go ahead and get that started and welcome Ione McMillan, my co-host. How are you this evening?
I'm doing well. Thank you. Julius, what's up, man?
Hey, Ione, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, pretty good. We're really excited about being here on the podcast today. I was I couldn't find my notes from our previous meeting before. What are they about to ask me? I have no idea what's going on.
Well, I think that every question that I ask you, you'll definitely be able to answer. It's not going to be anything technical. I'm going to give a quick little intro because you know, you're a special guest. You're someone that I came across your work before I came across you, and that was about two months ago or so, where I was looking up on Investopedia about doing a rollover for an IRA, And I already knew the term transfer, but in this article, you were being quoted in Investopedia and talking about how transferring your IRA from one custodian to the next is better than a rollover and doesn't make you liable to certain rules that a rollover would. So with that, seeing that you were a Black man writer in, you know, in this kind of a financial website, I said, let me reach out to him and see if he would like to be a guest on the show, because, you know, we really host this podcast to have everyday, to have money conversation, investing conversations with everyday people. Because as we all know, generally we didn't grow up talking about money. And so I think that it behooves us, if we want to educate others or at the very least expose others, this podcast allows them to eavesdrop on those conversations. So, so with that being said, let's start with your childhood in Indiana. You know, you can tell us where specifically you grew up, but was money talked about in your household? Did you pick up certain things, habits, language, by osmosis, by just observing? What were kind of your first memories of money growing up?
Yeah, great question. So I actually grew up in Cincinnati, Ohio, where I was born and raised there. Our family moved to Indianapolis when I was 14, so around 2001, something like that. And, you know, when I grew up, there wasn't really anything talked about with regards to money, right? My parents were not the most financially literate individuals, right? They were like not financially literate, but they didn't have any books, readings. They didn't have any significant investments, anything like that, right? Typical, you know, middle class, at the time, really lower middle class, you know, African-American family. So I didn't really come across much with regards to just general concepts of personal or business finance at all. My parents tried to start a business, a medical billing and coding kind of like outsourced thing or whatever. And, you know, they bought like a computer and a printer and had some business cards and that was it, and didn't have a plan, didn't have anything. I know they didn't even have a bank account, right? So it was just kind of like, we're going to try this thing and, you know, go forward. And years later, as I look back, I'm like, wow, they had no chance of success, right? Because they had no foundation. And they didn't really know what they were doing. But that was, you know, that was the extent of it, right? There was no other conversations with regards to finance or money, really. With regards to growing money, it was always, we need some money, you know, or where's the money at, maybe, you know, but definitely not any significant conversation with regards to wealth building or investment stocks, any type of financial instruments, none of those things.
Yeah, you know, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, you make a really good point, and something I had, I think, really come to terms with or thought about last week was the fact that when you grow up not talking about money or not knowing what investing is, then what you actually grow up believing is, I have to only work for it. And it's the most subtle assumption that's made, but almost all of us are operating it. It dictates where we go to school, what major we major in, and the professions we decide. Because if we want to make a lot of money, the only way we know how is, I gotta get into one of the highest paying professions in order to make money. So with that being said, I mean, you know, you're watching your parents do these things, just like all of us. How did you then choose your college? How did you then choose your major? What was your thought process as you were seeking out higher education and then, you know, trying to find maybe a career?
Yeah, and you're right. So my process with regards to, you know, finding a school was based on the notion that going to school will get me a degree, and getting me a degree will get me the job, and getting me the job will get me the salary, and the salary will give me the house. You know, this kind of thing that was dependent on, of course, being an employee, right? And so I didn't really come across any type of, I guess, real entrepreneurship ideology until maybe the last years of college, to be quite honest, right? Something that was realistic that I could reach and grasp after, right? There were things talked about, you know, there was a whole entrepreneurship degree. I went to Indiana University at the Kelly School of Business, right? You know, you have degrees and stuff like that, but it was still kind of theoretical. I really didn't know at that point many people that looked like me in my early college years that were successful entrepreneurs. It wasn't until much later, after I joined a fraternity, met people who were successful, men that looked like me and were like actual millionaires. And then I said, okay, wow, there's a whole different shift. There's a whole different thing out here for individuals that look like me. And so to backtrack a little bit, when you asked me about when did I really start hearing about money or learning about money, it was my freshman year in college. And how things come full circle, you found me based upon an Investopedia article, right, that I reviewed and contributed to. Well, that was the first place I learned about money, was the Investopedia stock simulator in 2005, right?
Wow.
I had no idea what stock was or trading or no idea what anything was. And my roommate, he had accumulated, because on the stock simulator, they give you like $100,000 or something to play with. You know, he had accumulated like $6 million or something in the simulator. And I'm like, what is this guy doing? What is this game he's playing? And realize that it's a game, but it's a parody of what's happening in the real world.
Simulation of real life, right.
Yeah. So it wasn't until I was 18, 19 that I really started to see anything that looked like wealth building, money, et cetera. And then, of course, like I said, joining fraternity, you know, a Black Greek organization, seeing men who were not just Black professional men, but also very successful entrepreneurs, right? And so, yeah, it wasn't until much later in life. So I don't know if that put me at a disadvantage or not, possibly. But, you know, I judge that based upon friends who did have those conversations in their home, you know, friends that didn't really look like me, and they're, you know, some of them aren't doing that well. So it really just depends on how you look at it, if that conversation puts you at an advantage or not, basically.
Yeah, I think for us, our biggest thing is just about exposure, because like the summer program that we did this summer, even though it wasn't the Investopedia stock simulator, it was with the SIFMA Foundation, but they have the same stock market game, and each team gets $100,000 to invest. And, you know, for people that know how to invest and the dangers of trading, you know, their first thought is, oh, you know, is this game good for kids because it's going to teach them to trade? We've done this experience 2 years in a row. And when it comes to Black kids, the reality is you think we may be trading, but we've never even seen that much money before.
True.
So
true.
I've actually witnessed the majority of us Black youth and Black adults be paralyzed.
Yeah.
They wait 6-8 weeks to make their first trade in a 10-week simulation because they just never even was exposed to that much money. And they're so scared of making a mistake that they don't make any decision, any move. You know, so I think that it didn't necessarily put you at a disadvantage, but I think just like anything, if you kind of are exposed earlier to the right way of doing things, or a healthy way, I should say, of doing things, then by the time you pick it back up later in life, it's an easier like habit to form because you were already exposed to the healthy way of doing it.
True. You know, it's funny you mentioned the shock of seeing a certain amount of money. And my personal experience with that was 2009, 2010. I was finishing college, finishing university, and I knew at that point that I didn't want to go immediately working in corporate America. I wanted to do a business. I had an idea, and there was one of my fraternity members. He was a very old guy at the time. He was maybe in the 70s. He owned a chemical company in Indianapolis. He was worth, you know, a few hundreds of millions of dollars, and I was told that I can go to him. He was an angel. I can go to him and seek funding for my business. And so the first idea I took to him, you know, he ripped it up. You know, he said this was, you know, he literally said it was like dog poop, S-H-I-T, and threw it in my face. And I said, wow, I couldn't believe he made me feel this little. And then that just gave me the, you know, the incentive to come back. Because he said, come back if you have a better idea. So a few months later, I came back. And, you know, after a few back and forth and due diligence and all these different kind of things, he wrote a check for, you know, almost $600,000. And so I know that at that time I was, you know, roughly 21. I had never seen even $60,000, right? No one in my family had seen anything like that. And so I was sitting in my car when I went to go pick up the check, and I had to ask myself, is this real? Is this really, is this a fake check? Like, is this, you know, what's happening here, right? And so, and to be quite honest, it sat in the bank account for about a month or two before we even did anything, because I was afraid that I would hit the wrong button, it would disappear, or, you know, something, right? It was this kind of, this, you know, shock is what it
surreal.
Was.
Surreal, yeah, it's surreal.
Yeah, this economic cultural shock is what I call it, right? It's just like, you know, an amount of money that is, you know, peanuts to someone else, for me was something that kind of blew my mind, you know. Oh, did I say that? I'm sorry. I didn't mean to say that, Howard.
We have some old timers on. If nobody knows, but you have Better Investing members. I mean, I have a friend, a lady. We've been trying to get her on the show. But she literally just turned 96.
Oh, okay.
And she's still investing. So, and she's not old. So we have some even younger BI members now. So,
yeah.
So 70 years old.
I meant to say he was more seasoned, I guess. That's the word I was looking for. Not necessarily old.
So. Oh, man. So, yeah, talk to us more about that moment and what did you have to go through to get comfortable with $600,000, even as, you know, being an entrepreneur, having someone believe in you, getting very quickly having access to, you know, this amount of money. Everybody says this amount of capital, right?
Yeah.
How did you have to level up even mentally and emotionally to be able to start, I guess, raising the bar for your norm?
Yeah,
we'll get to where you are now in the amount that you're exposed to of people and their experience, but, you know, it'd be nice to hear the progression.
Yeah, that's a great question, and it took, I went to, you know, business school, all that, but I wasn't ever a student of business until that point, to be quite honest, right, because in college, I was just going through the motion, reading the textbook, doing the test, right? Didn't really care, trying to graduate, trying to go to a party, whatever it was. But the moment that I got this injection of capital into the company, was called Food Shared at the time. And believe it or not, it was something that we do now, right? So it was restaurant delivery. So DoorDash, Uber Eats is this now, but in 2009, 2010, especially in Indianapolis, that was a foreign concept. Even me just trying to sell it to restaurant owners was difficult. It was 2 years of struggle, right? That's a whole different conversation. But when I look at DoorDash, Uber Eats, and these things now, I'm like, wow, really? You know, I was just too early to the market, right? But, you know, I wasn't a student of business until then. So what I mean is that I now started to, you know, read and understand terminology that I had, you know, I had skimmed over in college but didn't really get because I had no way to apply it really, right? And, you know, I didn't really become comfortable with it until maybe, I don't know, 2 or 3 years later when it became the norm for the bank account levels to be normal, you know, above, you know, six figures, right? But the hardest thing about having it is being afraid to spend it. That's the, you know, not knowing if my expense is going to be an expense or an investment, right? Trying to juggle these concepts of what's an expense here, what's an investment, you know. But the most important thing that happened is what really kicked off investing for me as far as personal finance goes, is that out of what he wrote us, we didn't need all of it. We were overcapitalized, believe it or not, right? It was a small shop, got a small $400 office, two computers, two or three cars, four employees, right? We were overcapitalized. We had enough money to last, you know, X amount of time. And so we took a portion of that and took it to a friend who was a financial advisor to invest it for us, right? And so, and this is when I really started to educate myself about what is personal finance and how I can start to build wealth for myself and my family, you know. So, and that was 2009. That portion that we had invested is still going for me today over 12 years later, you know. And so it was that kind of early, interaction with the finance world. Because, again, my mom had never been to a financial advisor. My dad had never been to a financial. They don't even know what I'm talking about, right? They have no idea what's going on. So it was just kind of a new thing for everyone in our family when I told them this is what I was going to do. But I even told them I had an angel investor. They had no idea what that was, right? You know, so I even had to start educating my mom and dad and family about what was happening just so they didn't think, you know, I was some kind of drug dealer, you know?
Exactly. Like, how you come across that much money so fast?
Yeah, they're like, wait a minute, you had a who? Is that what you mean? Is that, you know, angel dust? That's what my mom, she said, angel dust? Angel, you know, I'm like, what is, I didn't know what angel dust. I'm like, what are you talking about? Is that drugs? Oh, you know, I have no idea, right? Yeah. So just a matter of educating them to let them know how I wasn't on anything that was deviant. This is something that is going to be fruitful and beneficial for me. And I was very young at the time. And that was another issue that I had. I know this is a side note, but that was another issue I had as a 20-year-old, 21-year-old guy trying to do business development in Indianapolis. You know, Indiana is, you know, certain organizations where
majority,
you know,
right?
Majority right. You're talking about a place where, you know, the Grand Dragon, whatever the guy's name of the clan, used to reside there for 25 years, right? So imagine me going out in central Indiana trying to develop my business and get accounts and get, you know, restaurant partners to sign on so we can deliver our food, right? So we were overcapitalized. We had enough money. You know, we had the ambition. We had everything. We even had support for the back office, but at the end of the day, it was very hard to get one consumer to understand you could have more than just chicken and pizza delivered and Chinese food. And then it was hard to get restaurant owners to sign a partnership agreement with a 20-year-old, you know, black kid, you know. So it was a very interesting time.
You know, I'm really glad that you brought that up, though, because the part sometimes that we don't we may not want to admit to ourselves is that sometimes any part of life, we can only hear a certain type of person, you know, and a lot of times we can only hear generally if it's new information or information that you may have trust issues around, you could probably only hear somebody that look like you, sound like you, make you feel good in the sense of connected and heard, you know, and that goes even down to the dialect. You know, does this person talk like me? Does this person sound like me? And I think, you know, I mean, you know, not that we have to even get into race issues, but to me, fundamentally, a lot of times it's hard for somebody to hear what you're saying because their eyes is looking at a distraction, know? And so sometimes you don't know. And I've been in some recent spaces where it's like, I don't know if it's because I'm black. I don't know if it's because I'm a woman. I don't know if it's because I'm younger than everybody else. But, you know, I do recognize sometimes I won't be heard because, you know, I look a certain way and they just not hearing me.
It's a combination of all those things for me in that time frame. And it was also the disbelief of them not coming across because, you know, part of the kind of the pitch deck I used to have for these restaurant partners at that time was showing them that we had enough capital as a small business to be stable and to grow with them, right? As delivery sales increased, we had enough to grow with them. We weren't just going to be delivering their food and then the whole thing, you know, blows up and becomes great and we go out of business, right? And so once I came to that part of the slide deck, and they're like, wait, you are a 20-year-old guy, you know, and you guys got $500,000-$600,000, really? He have never even seen, you know, any of his kids or any nephews or any people that look like him in that same position. So it was a disbelief that this was even real, right? And that happened a few times, and where they just told me, is this even real? Are you really who you say you are? And I'm just like, why wouldn't I be, you know? I'm trying to get some money here, buddy, you know? So it's a combination of all those things, I think.
Yeah. Wow, nice. So let's go back to the hiring of the financial advisor. How did you know him? How did you vet him, if you even did vet him? Because, you know, working with financial advisors is great if they're worth their salt, if
Correct.
They're fiduciaries, if they know
Correct.
What they're doing, if they're experienced, if they're willing to continue to learn. And sometimes some people's experience is not that good, even if it's somebody they trust or know. Sometimes it's great. So I'm interested to hear how your experience, how you continue, because you mentioned it before, how you continue to not just trust this individual to do it for you, but you also started to educate yourself so that you could either learn what he's doing or at least keep up to speed with what he's talking about. Because I think that that's the most important part when you are engaging with financial advisors or anybody that you think that you're going to give them your money and they're going to make it grow for you. But if you're not understanding the terms that they're saying, if you're not understanding the investments that they're making for you, the securities, if you're not understanding the mix, if you're not understanding even your own risk risk level, then you know, you just kind of set yourself up to be taken advantage of.
Yeah, that's true. That's a great question. This individual was referred to me by someone in my community. So my faith community, I came up in a Muslim household. And so with regards to, there's an entire concept called Islamic finance, right? Whereby certain things are prohibited, interest, et cetera, you know, interest-based products, things like this, gambling, high levels of speculation, high levels of uncertainty, things like this, right? So when we realized we were overcapitalized and we had, you know, a little bit over 100 grand to kind of play with, I was referred to a financial advisor from someone in our community, right, and from our faith tradition, who was going to invest our money in a way that was, you know, in alignment with our religious principles, right? And so at the time, I think it was, I still have a portfolio there. The company is called Allied Asset Advisors, and they had something called the Man Fund, the Growth Fund. And so it was mainly, you know, like 85% stocks or whatever. But what happened is that for a lot of the Muslims in America that want to invest in we call it Sharia compliance standpoint, a lot of these stocks have to be vetted basically from like two angles, right? So vetted with regard to their business activity. So we're basically not allowed to invest in stocks that from companies that, you know, produce things like, you know, gambling, you know, pornography, you know, weapons, defense, anything that can hurt someone, you know, any type of alcohol, wild entertainment things, et cetera. So they've been vetted with regards to their business activity. Then there's vetting from a financial ratio standpoint, whereby they can only have a certain amount of debt to equity, et cetera. So, you know, some companies, they say, you know, less than 30% of debt with regards to their equity. They, you know, their accounts receivable should be less than 50%, like all these kind of benchmarks to make it a less riskier investment, a safer investment, things like that. And so I knew the person, I grew up knowing this individual, And so I was comfortable with them. And so I was definitely comfortable giving them, like, you know, an amount of money that I've never seen before, right? But the biggest thing about it that even I tell friends and family now, so I'm not a personal finance guru at all. Corporate finance is my thing. But the biggest thing that people, in my opinion, who are afraid to invest or don't know anything, they feel like, because I felt this and I had to overcome this, that I was giving it and I would, you know, it's like basically, it's like a payment that you'll never see again instead of an investment that is there to potentially grow, right? That you still have access to in some way, shape, or form, right? And so that's what the biggest thing is, like, I want to write this guy a check and I want to give it over. And I just basically spent $100,000 on some advice, you know? So we're getting over that hump. That allowed me to be even more comfortable with it. And it ended up being, like I said, even today, still very fruitful for me. So
I think you were very blessed, lucky and blessed in the sense that you did at least have somebody in your community.
Yeah.
Even if you didn't know it before, until the opportunity arose, mm-hmm. you had somebody in your community that you could talk to about it, somebody that you already trusted.
True.
And, you know, going back to this is the real purpose of our podcast, mm-hmm. because, you know, we had a guest on last week where, you know, didn't talk about money or investing in the home. And while she was learning about it, none of her parents didn't know about it. Mm-hmm. Her friends didn't know about it. And so, you know, out of her story, she talked about how she literally had to get a whole nother network of people because mm-hmm. she was learning information that was really forming her life and exposing her to how she could live as an investor, not just as an employee that happens to invest, you know. But in order to do that, you kind of have to have access to people that are doing the things or, in a sense, are where you're trying to go.
Yeah. I agree. Yeah, no, I agree with that. Because there are a lot of charlatans and things like this that exist. So you're right in the sense that I didn't come across some slick-talking guy who was just an insurance salesman and not a real, you know, investment advisor, you know. And, yeah, so you're right. I was definitely, you know, lucky and blessed to be guided in the right direction, I think. Yeah.
So yeah. One of the things we talked about before, and are you an alpha or was it Kappa?
I'm a member of Kappa Alpha Psi fraternity.
Okay. Right. I knew I was gonna get that wrong.
Okay.
I need to remember that next time. Sorry about that. I didn't mean to offend anybody. So yes, talk to us about being a member of Kappa Alpha Psi and the man that you met that really helped to launch you into this whole new sphere of corporate finance.
Yeah. You know, Kappa Alpha Psi really changed my life in many respects. So, you know, when I got to college, I was just, you know, this, you know, kid who didn't have many professional experiences. I didn't own a suit, didn't know how to tie a tie, didn't know how to wear a belt. You know, none of these things, you know, because my father wasn't that kind of guy. You know, I never seen him in a suit ever in his life, right? You know, so even to this day, I don't even think the guy owns a suit or even knows how to wear one, right? So he's a very blue-collar individual. I'm not saying that all blue-collar people are like this, but he was extremely blue-collar. And he, you know, I mean, come on, you know, yeah, that's a whole different conversation. But when I joined Kappa Alpha Psi in college, I was exposed to men who were mainly businessmen, professionals, right? Black professionals, which, again, is something I never really saw. The only black professional I saw growing up was my dentist in Cincinnati, and that was it. I never saw a black lawyer, never saw a black accountant. Never saw a black doctor. I never saw a black actuary. Didn't even know what an actuary was till Kappa Alpha Psi. Never saw any of those things, right, until I joined the fraternity. And so for me, it was like one of those things that was transformative in the sense of shaping my identity as a Black professional, right? Understanding even what that means. And so during that time, I came across a man named William G. Mays. He was a member of the Alpha Chapter at Indiana University, or alumni member. So he, like I said, he was very seasoned, well into his 70s at the time, I believe, late 60s, something like that. And we were at a banquet, and, you know, somebody told me, hey, you know, that guy over there, he's worth about $400 million. I said, what? You know, I never, that's not a thing, you know. Like, it's like on TV or a movie or Bruce Wayne, you know, kind of thing, right? And so he was very warm and inviting, and, you know, I was able to sit with him and talk with him and just get an entirely different perspective about a lot of things, actually. And he's someone that, you know, started a chemical company. He worked for Dow Chemical for a while and then started distributing chemicals himself, right, getting contracts, you know, from certain countries and distributing himself from, you know, went from like a $10,000 revenue business to 30 years later, you know, something like $150 million, right? So I never met anyone like that before, ever. It doesn't matter what the race, doesn't matter. I never met anyone like that, right? That was outstanding to me. So, you know, meeting him and knowing that that was achievable outside of TV and movies, I really knew that this is, you know, I can have to start realigning what my life might look like. And that's kind of what pushed me towards entrepreneurship. So I met him my sophomore year of college, and we had kept in contact because my, we call it like Lion Brothers, somebody I pledged with, it's his nephew, actually. So in the summertime, he used to invite us over onto his yacht. Again, a Black man with a yacht. This is something, you know, I don't even know how to swim. So, you know, it's like one of those things. I'm just going to go anyway just to say I was on a yacht, right, you know. But we used to go in the summertime, and I was able to develop a relationship with him. Howard, oh, you're an alpha. I'm so sorry. You know, maybe in another lifetime you can choose a different organization. No, I'm joking with you. So I developed a rapport with him over a few years, and when it was time for me to go and seek the investment, he knew me, and, you know, he gave me a hard time, of course. It was a few months of kind of meetings and, you know, pouring him, you know, coffee, you know, like I was some kind of pledge or something, right? But at the end of the day, he knew me, he was comfortable with me, and this is why he was able to part with X amount of money. So it was a great experience. He passed away in 2014. And I wasn't the only person he helped out, right? There's a lot of people in Indianapolis, throughout the United States, actually, you know, that he helped out. He's a member of the various groups, NAACP, Sigma Pi Phi, Boulay, like all these different groups that, you know, essentially he had connections with, and he was an angel for other, you know, African-American and Hispanic entrepreneurs in America. So I think that when he died, I was told that he had invested in and or loaned over $170 million, right, to people in over a 20-year time span. So I thought that was phenomenal. I never met anyone like that before in my life. So it was a transformative relationship.
Yeah, and I didn't realize that was who you were talking with, talking about and had the relationship with, because I think I know of him just from being around Black Enterprise and him being listed on the, you know, BE100 list. Yeah, because he was the like only Black man and that owned a chemical, you know, company in the Midwest. So yeah. I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, him and Bob Johnson were like best friends, and they used to, you know, do this Black Enterprise thing and Forbes thing all the time, and, you know. So, yeah, it was a transformative experience for me, and let me know that, you know, what is possible, right? Mm-hmm. Because I know a lot of people who have never met anyone like that, and, you know, their mind was never in a space to be transformed to see what was possible with regards to building wealth.
Definitely. So as you mentioned, building wealth, let's go back to, you know, having this first opportunity to invest $100,000, mm-hmm. having a financial advisor within the Islamic community you grew up with that you trusted. Do you remember any of the books that you started to read at that time? I like how you laid out how the money was being invested, you know, based on the community's principles. because we want to hear how your own personal investing philosophy developed and what it is now.
Yeah, the first book I read was The Tried and True, Robert Kiyosaki, Rich Dad, Poor Dad. That was the first book I was exposed to. You know, a roommate told me about it. I had no idea what he was talking about. I read this book and I was like, wait a minute. I just felt like everybody had lied to me. You know, at every point before that, reading that book, I felt like everyone had lied to me and that no one knew anything except for this guy and people like him, right? I was in a space where that, you know, that was the first kind of book about money and investment and wealth building that I had read. And it just kind of just blew my mind. I think most people were like that. It was just kind of, you know, defining what are assets, liabilities. It was a mind-blowing thing for me, right? Because no one, you know, I didn't have a, I guess I had all poor dads, right? You know, no one ever talked about stuff like this, right? That was the first kind of, book I read. And there was a lot of different books over time, you know, Psychology of Money by Morgan, Hansel or something like that. You know, Intelligent Investor, right? Ben Graham's book, right? So there's a few texts I had read over time that were both prominent and not prominent. But at the end of the day, I realized that when it came to personal finance, that I was never going to be the most educated person about it. And so I was very comfortable putting my personal financial growth in the hands of someone else, a trusted individual advisor, just like I would do with my health with a doctor or, you know, my legal issues with a lawyer. And it was not in the sense that I wasn't able to comprehend, because obviously it's my field, but it was just something that didn't interest me as much as understanding, you know, complex capital structures in a corporation, for example, right? And so it was one of those things that I had to figure out where I'm going to spend my time at. And it wasn't going to be, you know, learning different tactics. And this is largely because I did make an attempt for about an 8-month time frame at swing trading / day trading. And it didn't really
work out.
Thank you
for that disclaimer, right?
Yeah, it was one of those things where it just didn't work out for me too well. And I'm like, you know. I'm just going to push this into the hands of people who are there, who have time, who have the ability and skill. I think there's a skill there with regards to investing and growing your own personal finances. I think there is, whether, you know, you do it in a complex way or a very simple way, there is some skill there that I didn't choose to, you know, put a lot of my time in. So I don't know if that answers your question or not, but.
Yeah, it does. It does. And in fact, what it also brings to light is the fact that, you know, through your entrepreneurial experience, having your business become overcapitalized, recognizing what you did not know with the extra money, because I don't know anybody, and that was another thing I was going to say earlier, you know, I don't know anybody that's an entrepreneur that even has enough confidence in their business structure, their sales cycles, their all of that, to even say that they're overcapitalized, and then not just have that money sitting in reserves.
Correct.
The next mind-blowing step of saying, you know what, we have the business down, let's use this extra money to grow for the business and, you know, have it, you know, make money while it's sitting there. Very rarely will you see those two things outside of Fortune 500 companies. You know, when it comes down to small businesses and everyday people being entrepreneurs, rarely will you see those two concepts combined, especially within the business. So I think it's actually very interesting that, you know, from that opportunity, you got introduced to personal finance. But that, in addition to the exposure, was a springboard for you to get into corporate finance. So I hear that you're trusting your financial advisor to take care of your personal finances. So talk to us about what ultimately made you choose corporate finance And one of the things that we talked about in our original conversation is, I think two things. One, a lot of people that's even in corporate finance
mm-hmm.
are not investing personally.
Yeah, it's true, actually.
So if you want to share more about that, you can. But two, just also talk about what you're exposed to, in a sense, in being in these high finance circles. I think it's interesting to hear. Some people may feel like they're missing out, as you may know, because you walked in both worlds. You may not be.
Yeah, that's a good question. I'll answer backward to forward. So I'm a CFO advisor, chief financial officer advisor. So I'm an outsourced and fractional CFO for businesses that generate between $500,000 up to $20 million, right? So between this range, you really can't afford a full-time CFO, generally speaking. And anything past that range, sometimes things start to get a little bit more complex. You start to get into, as you call it, high finance, right? And so just being in the space, I have clients that have, assets that are in this $17 million range, right? I have a client that has assets almost touching $100 million, right? And so the space just lets me know that, or it reminds me of, It reminds me of when I used to be excited about crumbs. Okay. And I don't say that from the sense of being egotistical or trying to be, what's the other word I'm looking
higher
for?
Higher than superior.
Yeah, no.
Right.
Not at all. I'm saying in the sense of recognizing that there are people with, they wake up and they're stressing about, $30, $40, $50 million in their business. And there was a point in my life when I was worried about, $60,000, right?
Right.
And so it just kind of, reminds me every time I sit with the client in a monthly huddle session and we're reviewing, we're building out a plan, whatever it may be, executive action plan, and reviewing target numbers and goals. And, I'm reminded they're in the millions and hundreds of millions that, that my mentality should always be, growing. Like, my clients' funds are growing, right? Because at some point they're going to, catapult past, a certain an amount. And I can never be thinking about like a $60,000 Julius, if that makes sense, right? If I'm going to be an effective CFO advisor and help take my clients' companies to the level that they need to go or pass them off to a full-time CFO, et cetera, I always have to be in a growth mentality, right? And so just logging into, clients' books, seeing, and I'll give you an example. My sister has no idea what I do, for example. She doesn't get anything. I remember one time I was drafting a report for a client and showing her, some gross margins for a client. And, it was something like, like $9 million or something like that. She's never seen anything like that before. So it just, me, I've been in the space. I get it. I see it. It's nothing. It's normal, right? It's like a banker, opening up a, ledger. They see all this, But for an individual who doesn't see it, it's like, what? What is that? Is this real? So it just lets you know that there's always going to be that disparity. But it also drives home a lot of other kind of, concepts with regards to inequality and these kind of things, in our society, how, 6, 7, 8, or $600 million is normal for some people, but then there's others that, are living on tuna all day, right? So it drives home those concepts even more as I sit in the middle, of these two groups, right? If that makes sense. Because some of my clients, I'll be quite honest, they came from some money and they don't know anybody that eats tuna all day, right? So they don't get that kind of mentality, right? So for me, I sit in the middle of it and I'm just constantly reminded, of these things. So that's the first question. What was the other question? I'm sorry.
Well, both the other question, because I have to go back on this right here.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, because I think you make a really good point, and I think I want more clarity and explanation just around compare the two different mindsets. The $600,000 check holding Julius in the car, stuck, and, you know, the Julius now, because I think you do make a point about how important a growth mindset is.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm interested to hear the differences, but I'm also interested to hear how certain qualities or characteristics, and I don't know the word for it, but some things are, like, let's say diligence. Some mm-hmm. things may be the same, no matter, you know, and you kind of have to master the 100,000 and the 600,000 to even be able to master the 600 million,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. So I guess the difference between that Julius and this one is comfort, being comfortable with these type of numbers. And I think that's really important even before you can have a growth mentality, right? Being comfortable. Because you even said in the simulator, they set 10 weeks with 100,000 and didn't even invest it.
Exactly.
Didn't even start to take the risk, right?
Exactly.
So you have to be comfortable. So confidence is the first thing I would say, is I'm comfortable now. The second thing I would say the difference is really understanding what that, what 600,000 or 6 million, what does this even mean? What do these numbers even mean? How did it come to be, and how can it be implemented, right? What are these? Because, you know, when I saw $600,000 as a 20-year-old, I mean, my mind was limited to, of course, trying to invest in simple things in the business, advertising, et cetera, you know, maybe buying, you know, some Jordans or something at the time that I liked. But it wasn't even anything compared to all the different various investment instruments that I know about now and the opportunities I know about now. So it's just my mindset of how something can be utilized is completely different. I had no idea then. And
very,
actually,
very much so.
Yeah, you know, to the point where I'm thinking, if I could go back in the future and take, or in the past, excuse me, from what I know now, with $600,000 in 2009, 2010, oh, God. I would have probably, you know, I don't know, started a lemonade stand, you know, for $50,000 and took the other $550,000 to the, you know, to an investment opportunity, right? Just because of what I know, if that makes sense, you know. So the difference is comfort and understanding how that money can be utilized, which I think goes into the entire concept of education, which your organization is all about, right? So those are the differences. Those are the major differences, I think, between the two.
I really like what you said, because I didn't realize that was the key, but it does come full circle to the beginning of our conversation, which is,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I think, and you can confirm if not, correct me, but I think comfort is directly linked to awareness and exposure.
Yeah.
You know, because like you said, if you didn't know about investing, and then all you knew with money is either saving it or spending it on things you like Jordans and this and that, you just didn't even know the possibilities of what else was out there that you could be doing. So my question then is, how did you continue to expose yourself to those options? Because, you know, the Julius now knows alternative investments,
yeah.
stock investment, I mean, buying businesses, fractional CFOing, you know, talk to us about, I guess, in terms of your lifestyle, is it continuing to meet new people, continuing
yeah.
to join different organizations, continuing to read different books? How are you constantly expanding your sphere of awareness? And like you mentioned, continuing to feed your growth mindset.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's a great question. And it comes down to my exposure to people in different groups, sitting at certain tables that I would have not have sat at before. So, for example, I took on a client last year who is in the chemical manufacturing industry, believe it or not, right? They were a small startup. And they were going through a Series A round of funding, and the individuals that were funding them, it was a private equity firm, they essentially invest in a bunch of things in Africa, et cetera. So there were some things, for example, if I would have not sat in the conversation with them and known about these things that they were doing, I would have no idea they existed, right? These different types of, we have a framework in America with regards to finance and investment vehicles, but I didn't know at the time, this is about 2 years ago, that in West Africa, in Nigeria, for example, there's certain other types of vehicles that, be quite honest, it might be riskier, but it seems more attractive to me at a certain level, right? So to be quite honest, it is, I think, 100% or 90% the people and being exposed to different groups and sitting in different conversations, with the individuals who have the money, right, who have the money at a certain level, who are diversified, right? And so that's what it really comes down to. What rooms are you in? What tables are you sitting at? Because at a certain level, certain relationships have to be built. You have to hear about certain things to even get involved in them, right? Finance.
Close-knit circle.
I only want certain people in it to benefit, certain people to know about it, right, for whatever reason, right? And so if you're not in those conversations or in those meetings or even being considered to be in those conversations, then there's a lot of things being missed out on, right? Completely missed out on, opportunities being missed out on. I'll give another example. I had a meeting with I live in Marion County, Indianapolis, or Indiana, about 3-4 years ago. I was, I have a residence abroad in America, right? So I have a home in Egypt and some in America, right? And so I was back home visiting, a couple of months, and one of my friends is the assistant assessor, county assessors. They deal with properties, back tax, et cetera. So I was invited to a lunch, which turned into being invited to a gala. And basically during that time was able to sit in a conversation and to be of the first individuals to discover some properties that were going to be released by the city that had some issues with taxes, et cetera, right? And this information came to me, and it wasn't illegal or anything like that before it was given out on the public forum, right? And so I was able to strategically prepare for it before it went out on the public forum and set X amount of dollars aside so I can purchase 15 homes for, an extremely discounted rate, right? So again, I would have never been in that conversation or part of it if it wasn't for the type of people I was around or associated with. So people and associations and relationships, I think, is the 90% reason why I've had even any opportunity and what continues to fuel growth mentality.
Well, thank you.
I feel like I'm talking too much here.
I mean, you hitting it. This is the first time I opened up the show like that to share that. But you are also reinforcing really how we have access to opportunities, how we have access to information. A lot of times it's not just in a book. It's meeting someone that has the knowledge, because we all know people. We all are born into families. We all have routines. We all work with people. But are you coming into contact with the type of people that can level up, your financial situation in a wholesome way, or expose you to other alternative opportunities, for you to start to build wealth in a way that's not just going to work, getting a pension, investing in a 401k. And even if you have access to that, are you coming across somebody to tell you need to do that? Because a lot of us, we're going to work, but we are only contributing what the company matches. And even when we're doing that, we're still not choosing what it's being invested in. So
we're
saving for retirement. We're not even investing for retirement.
Very true. I agree with that.
We do have an audience question. Somebody asked, and I think this is a little bit of a segue to your other career, but somebody asked, did you get an advanced degree? Did you go back to school to get an advanced degree? And I'm going to intro to say that you actually also teach at two different universities. So talk to us about, how you even became an academic and why you choose to be an academic, the fact that you're on Fulbright right now and are running your own business?
Yeah, it's a great question. I do have an advanced degree. I have a master's degree in finance with the information technology specialization from Colorado State University. I'm currently a PhD student as well. So I'm here in the Kingdom of Bahrain, which is in the Arabian Gulf. So it's a little small, rich country where the American dollar is virtually worthless here, right? You know, the currency, I think it's a 3-to-1 or something like that. I went to buy a Gatorade when I first came here, and it was like 3 dinar, right? So I'm thinking, okay, it's like $3, right? For whatever is in my head, I just didn't even check the currency conversion. It ended up being like $15, you know? I'm like, what? This is crazy. I will not survive here, you know? So I'm here on a federally funded program called Fulbright, right, which is as a research scholar. Here researching the impact and challenges for the financial technology sector within the banking sector here in this country, and so producing a thesis and a paper for it. I'm an adjunct professor of finance at what's the term? So you got HBCU, right, like Howard, and there was a cutoff for when a university could be considered an HBCU. So it's called a predominantly black institution. Anytime after 19, I forget the date, the cutoff, the federal cutoff to be considered HBCU, they're called PBI, predominantly black institution, right? So I am an adjunct professor of finance and accounting at one in Martin University in Indianapolis, small university, about 2,000 students, mostly undergrads. And also a lecturer at a community college in Indianapolis as well, accounting lecturer at a community college there. So I enjoy academia so much. I enjoy it as much as I enjoy business. I enjoy reading. I enjoy writing about it. I enjoy uncovering and adding new knowledge right to the world from a finance and economics perspective. It's hard finding the balance sometimes, right, to be quite honest, because there's and not only finding the balance, but shifting the mentality from being a kind of a forward-thinking business person, co-creator of the success for my clients' businesses, all these different kind of things, guiding their finance function, and then the next day having to sit and be reserved, not talk to anyone, and be kind of backward-thinking and analyzing what has happened. Any trends, et cetera, writing about it, analyzing it, and reporting on it, right? So finding the mental balance, the time balance sometimes is difficult, but I enjoy it so much that I'm often wondering if in, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years, am I going to continue with MaxPoint, sell it to another consulting firm, just go be a professor full time, or, stick with what I'm doing. The difficulty there is that you're a professor, you're just, you're still an employee, and, you're limited on what you can do. And, and this is the reason why I chose the adjunct role instead of full-time professorship, because you're limited in how much money you can make and these kind of things, which I have a problem with right now. So, I love the academic side of finance, and it's a great merger between the two, being an active member of the American finance community as a finance professional and understanding finance and economics from a theoretical standpoint. It really helps me in my practice, helps me, as your mom told me before this, be able to educate clients on why X, Y, and Z is happening and how we can prepare and how we can hedge our way into a different, position, in order to, beat any type of, economic odds that are coming up right now. So, it really helps, like I said, merge the gap between a professional and a theorist, and I really enjoy it, to be quite honest.
No, I think that's superb because, it takes a different type of person and a different type of mindset to be able to do two different, in a sense, career paths well. But for those of us who do them, it's almost like being – a Paul Robeson of the world, you really get to to feed your soul, feed your pocket, feed the minds of others. And it's almost like you can't do it any other way because you get so much fulfillment from these various ways of living. So, yeah, I'm glad you broke it down like that because you – Go ahead.
It was academia that actually took me out of America. And I'm going to be quite honest, it's one of the single most things in the past 10 years that's changed my mentality on living life, wealth, was living, being an expat for 6 months out of every year, right? So roughly about 6 months out of every year, I live in another country, right? To understand people, culture, lecture, et cetera. And that has really, you know, warped my mind in a good way to understand what money really is and what it means to even be wealthy and what's the point of all this anyway, you know, and what is most important, you know, being happy with family and this or having, you know, X amount of money in the bank, right? So, you know, 10 years ago, you know, I had a goal of, you know, there's a money goal, but as now that money goal has come down less because it's not as important as it used to be when I was 20, if that makes sense, right? Still important.
You have quality of life goals.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. And, you know, that has changed substantially. So I'm happy you mentioned that. I was just telling my friends, I made a post on Facebook about this, that I work a four-day work week right now, right? And I can't ever imagine going back to anything else because there was a time in my life between entrepreneurship and getting your corporate job and trying to do both, working, you know, 50, 60 hours, you know, not sleeping, you know, being irritable, you know, running into health issues because of it, right? All these different things just for money. At one point, I realized that this is not going to work. You know, it's not a realistic thing. And I shifted kind of the way I attack work and business about 4 years ago. And so I've been working a four-day work week ever since then, and it makes my quality of life, you know, better than having millions of dollars, to be quite honest. Because time is, you know, you can't – time is much better than money, in my opinion.
Exactly. So. And when, you know, when we distill down, because a similar thing happened to me, when you are younger, you want $1 million because what $1 million provides you.
Correct.
But when you get older, I think it takes some wisdom to realize that you could have those things without having yet reached the $1 million mark. So
true. No, very true.
That's good.
Yeah,
and it's great that you actually, again, have the awareness by having the opportunity to live abroad and see how other people are living their lives and how wealth is defined in other ways, you know. Through other values, you know, you really hit your money mark sooner because you really hit the qualitative perspective.
Definitely, you know, and it goes into our conversation about relationships. You know, I remember I used to lecture at a university in Saudi Arabia, and I came across an investment opportunity in date palm trees, right? Like, who imagined date palm trees could be a commodity that was extremely profitable, right? Extremely lucrative. You know, date palms per gram, I mean, I don't even know the going rate right now. At the time, it was something ridiculous. I don't know, like $25 or something like that. It was ridiculous. And it, you know, the tree itself, you can purchase the date palm tree. They come in quads for something like $100, but the tree produces, one tree produces something like $200,000 worth of date palms in less than, you know, 18 months, right? And, you know, it's just like stuff like that. If I was sitting in Indianapolis, I wouldn't even know what a date palm tree was. You know, what are these people talking about? So being able to travel and experience other business communities around the world, understanding what they are investing in. I made an investment in, there's a mineral, it comes from a tree. It's called acacia gum, and it's used inside of different pharmaceuticals, et cetera. And so like in 2015, I put an investment into an acacia gum extraction operation that did very well for about 4 years until I, you know, sold my share, right? So it's things like that. And, you know, we have no idea what this is, especially a little black here from Indianapolis. I don't know what this is. What are we talking about here, you know? So being able to travel, understand people was definitely crucial in my growth mentality.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed this, and I have to hand it over to Ms. Ann. But yeah, this is better than I expected, better than I imagined.
Yeah. Now my mouth is dry right now.
Are you sure, Ione, you're handing this over to me? So I just want to make sure that...
Yes, you have the reins. I thank you for giving me unfettered access. I think
grace.
Julius and I had a wonderful conversation. Yeah, he answered all my questions and more. And again, I knew this was going to be a great guest, but now that everybody has listened to the whole thing, now you see why, you know. And again, he graced us with his presence, but all we're doing is recreating the things that made him and the things that made me, and the things that we as a Better Investing community thrive on, because we are a community of self-educated, long-term, successful investors. But a lot of times the only way to get like that, you don't have access to Warren Buffett, but you have access to us, you know, people in their 70s, 80s, 90s, you know, that start early investing, but are in retirement, you know, fully invested, managing their own portfolios, you know, taking the lead. And even to this day, still putting themselves in opportunities and spaces to learn and to share and to give back to others. So thanks again, Julius.
Yeah,
all right.
You. I appreciate it so much. I've enjoyed this discourse. It's been amazing. And if I offended Mr. Johnson there, I apologize. I love alphas as well. I apologize about that. So I was just joking, Mr. Johnson.
Well, he has a good spirit. I think he did well.
He's one of our Better Investing volunteers, and he's more than just a volunteer. He's a brother, and he's actually over our entire southeastern region of the United States, and he represents us well. So he's just joking with you. We wanted to find out if you have any additional closing remarks as we prepare to wrap up this show tonight, Julius.
No, I just want to thank you all for inviting me here. I am now aware of your organization. Like I said, I didn't even know it existed before. And so I am, you know, I've been on your organization's website a few times over the past few weeks. And so I may even become a member. And I'm looking forward to chiming into the next podcast, right? And seeing who your next interviewee is.
Excellent, excellent. We want to just remind all of our listeners that you've been listening to hashtag My Investing Story. And our guest tonight, excuse me, Mr. Julius Mann, he's an emerging, if we can call you that, researcher, if you will. And he serves as a professor, as he told us tonight, at two institutions. And so also on a Fulbright, that was soon as a scholarship then, right? Program?
It's a research grant, actually. Yeah.
Okay,
the
research grant.
It's a research grant. So,
okay, yeah. Research grant with the Department of State. Mm-hmm. And so for those of you that are interested in learning more about Better Investing, you can go to betterinvesting.org. And also, if you're not a member and you would like to participate in our 90-day free membership, the membership is on the front page of the website. You can do that. But other than that, Julius, we cannot thank you enough. And Ione hit it right on the head and just sharing that and I said that actually, as we were talking, this is going to be a great, great podcast tonight. And it was. And actually, I took some notes. I'm not going to go through them because Ione has already hit most of them.
You can go through them if you want.
Well, of course, I was going to ask the question when you said Greek, and I too did not choose the right one. I'm going to tell you the one I chose. It wasn't the one that Howard said, but just being able though to know that your journey, and when you talked about the entrepreneur that invested in you, just kind of reminds us of how powerful it is to serve and to give, and not necessarily have to be that kind of money, but we can invest in others in a lot of different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And you blessed me tonight and talking about how he blessed you. But by doing this podcast, we are blessing people every single day that listen to this way after, you know, this show is over. Because so many of us did not know where to go. And we all, you know, many of us thought we had to have all this money to invest. And like Ione talked about in one of the notes I wrote, I have a small company and we also do have, you know, reserves at different times. And the psychology of knowing that this is a good investment is not a debt, you know, in terms of investing, you know, extra cash, if you will, versus sitting on it because you're not getting any interest on it. Basically, you're paying for the privilege of having it sitting there. So, so many things came up out of this, especially when you talked about your family and how it is not an excuse for any of us not to do better. And so whether we went to college or not, what better investing is teaching all of us, and I like to call it from my own experience, and that is the value of a $20 bill. And just do a little something, but keep doing something as we aspire to learn. And that's the other thing that you've shown us tonight in terms of being willing to learn and shift, you know, and really do that shift. So, of course, I had an opportunity to talk with you before the program started, and that was phenomenal. And so I'm going to wrap it up, Ione. Both of you, if you have any other comments, we know that all of our guests have hung in here with us. And we want to thank all of you for chiming in every single Wednesday and coming back. And if, again, if you have any questions or comments, you can put them in the chat. But other than that, we want to thank everybody for joining. And again, Julius, what a blessing. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Julius.
It's been a pleasure, man.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
All right, everybody. Okay, good night. Thank you.
Good night.
Well, good day for you, but.
Yeah, right.
All right, everybody. Good night.
Goodbye.